Hello, podcasters, and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and as you will know, in these podcasts, we examine different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. Now, in today's podcast, we look at some individual stories of Kilkenny natives on the front line during the Civil War in 1922. Now, I suppose just to be aware before we start, the term frontline is the broader definition of the word and not what you might think traditionally. As the Civil War was fought in the towns, villages, back roads and boreens of Ireland, people were thrust onto the front line of the fighting in many different ways. So there were people who didn't want to be involved at all, but got caught up in the conflict nonetheless through no choice of their own. Many of their stories are harrowing, but it highlights how the Civil War impacted people at a local level across all sections of society and right across County Kilkenny. There were others that chose to be on the front line, even if it was more of a necessity than a choice, really. For example, the wage of a Free State private was relatively generous for the time, at 3 shillings 6 pence per day. And if you were married, your wife back home also got a dependence allowance, which was 4 shillings per day. This increased to 7 shillings and 6 pence per day if your wife had three or more children. So the Free State Army was an attractive option to working class men, especially in the turmoil of Ireland in 1922, where jobs were hard to find and other parts of Europe were going through a retraction or recession after the First World War. It was also a much better wage than many of the farm labourers would have been used to, so you can see in purely economic terms why they would have enlisted in the Free State Army. In addition, many of these men would have had First World War experience in Irish regiments of the British Army, so they were useful for the Free State Army in that regard, as they really wouldn't have time to train them up. Of course, those on the anti-treaty side weren't getting paid a set wage. They believed they were fighting for the Republic, often for moralistic and righteous reasons they would have felt. From their point of view, Irish men taking a wage in the Free State Army to shoot on fellow Irishmen was seen as the lowest of the low. So there were many dynamics at play, is what I suppose I'm trying to say here, between the two sides. Now, the first story I will tell may not seem to be a Civil War story on the face of it, but it kind of is the more you think about it. So firstly, the story in question. On the 26th of June 1922, just on the eve of Civil War breaking out in Ireland officially, Thomas Tyrrell, a farmer from Clockpook, Muckalee, met a very sad end. He had been suffering from what we would call today mental health issues. This had resulted in him causing some trouble with his neighbours and generally being a nuisance to them. The previous day he had attacked some locals by throwing stones at them. These locals were hit in the legs and in the head and got some nasty gashes. As a result of this evidence, the local IRA decided to arrest Tyrrell. He was deemed to be not of sound mind and a lunatic in the parlance of that time. He had been in prison some years before for shouting down the priest during Mass, which was a big scandal at the time. And it should be noted that at this period, the IRA were doing the civilian police work in the absence of the RIC, which had been disbanded some months previously and before the Garda Síochána Conor were set up properly. In practice, the IRA police were just made up of local young men who were in the IRA, but some had been assigned to do police duties. They wouldn't have been paid, of course, for this. It was totally volunteer work, you could call it, doing it for one's country. Thus, a patrol of IRA men went to arrest Tyrrell at his home, led by local IRA OC, or Officer Commanding, Jim Conway. Now, when Tyrrell saw the men arriving, he charged from his house over a side wall into the front garden with a stick in his hand. He ignored all the calls to halt. One of the IRA police, Adjutant Edmund Marr of Muckalee, fired a shot into the air to try to get Tyrrell to stop, but he instead turned his attention to the others in the patrol. A shot was fired by a different IRA man, hitting Tyrrell in the chest. Sadly, he died very shortly afterwards, with the bullets having passed through his lung. Now, his death is related to the Troubled Times in one specific way. If this was pre-Troubles, the RIC would have been responsible for arresting Thomas. Although they could carry weapons, they usually wouldn't carry guns about every day, especially in rural Kilkenny. So Tyrrell would have been safer in that regard. The RIC would have a little bit more experience as well in regards to an event of this type. And if the incident had happened just 4 months later, from October 1922, the new Garda Síochána would have been in charge in that district by then. The Gardas were an unarmed police force, so wouldn't have been able to fire at Thomas even if they wanted to. So it was just very unfortunate for him that it happened at that particular juncture, being June 1922. He never got the chance to explain his side of things or perhaps get the medical help he needed. The local IRA commander later took statements from the IRA police who were in the patrol that were sent to arrest Tyrrell. Subsequently, he arrested two of the IRA policemen for the heavy-handed approach they had taken. They were later reprieved, and one of the men was later cautioned as a result of the incident. It's probably fair to say, though, that this event was probably traumatic for those young IRA men too. They would not have been trained in any way to deal with a situation like this. The later inquest returned the verdict that Tyrrell died as a result of a bullet wound accidentally received, and that there were no persons to blame for the occurrence. Now, as we might have mentioned in a previous podcast, towards the end of summer 1922, after the anti-treaty IRA had been dislodged from the major towns, they reverted to a mostly guerrilla strategy to compete with the much superiorly armed Free State Army. One man was at the receiving end of this change of tact. At about 4 p.m. on Tuesday the 15th of August 1922, that's the Feast of the Assumption, a group of Free State soldiers were travelling by lorry from Carrick-on-Shore to Waterford. Due to the destruction of the bridges in the south of the county, they took the longer route to Waterford via the village of Mon na Bhas, over the hills, as we call it, down this direction. About 3 kilometres before Mon na Bhas village, at Rochestown, they were ambushed by a group of anti-treaty IRA. The ambush took place at the bottom of Rochestown Hill. It's actually very close to where Pullanassie Waterfall is, which some of you may know. There's a lovely new car park there now as well. Trees had been cut down to block the road. The anti-treaty fired from both sides of the road, and a gunfight broke out, which lasted a number of minutes. Some soldiers jumped for cover from the lorry. The anti-treaty IRA called on the Free State soldiers several times to surrender, but they kept on fighting. In the altercation, 34-year-old John O'Keefe from 5 Alexander Street in Waterford City was killed. He'd been shot 4 times while still on the back of the lorry. Ironically, he was the only one on the lorry not actually a member of the Free State Army. He had travelled to Carrick-on-Shore that morning in order to enlist in the Free State Forces. Whatever happened, he mustn't have made the cut or something. So he jumped back onto the ill-fated lorry at the military barracks in Carrick-on-Shore to catch a lift back home to Waterford. It was much easier than walking. The senior officer on the lorry told him to get out, as civilians weren't supposed to be on board, but he stayed anyway and no more notice was taken of him. James O'Keefe was mourned by his wife and 6 children. He was employed as a dock labourer previously. He'd also fought in the First World War. His body was brought to De La Salle College in Waterford, where his inquest was held. De La Salle was acting as a temporary Free State military barracks at the time. He had been shot through the ribs and died quickly. One of the soldiers in the back of the lorry gave the following statement afterwards. Quote, "When he fell, his feet were across one of the other men in the lorry. I saw him breathing for about 2 or 3 minutes after being hit. He made some outcry and groaned after being hit, but later passed away." End quote. He was buried at St. Otran Cemetery in Waterford. A fund was opened for the deceased man's widow and children, with the mayor of Waterford City and the local Catholic bishop being the first to donate. Private Hogan, a Free State soldier also on the lorry, was wounded in the arm and leg, but luckily survived his injuries. In our next story, a Wednesday morning walk through the streets of Kilkenny turned to disaster for one city man. At around 12 noon on the 29th of November 1922, Patrick Griffin from Patrick Street was in the process of walking up to this train station, now McDonough Junction train station, to collect his delivery of Irish independent newspapers. Griffin was the local agent for independent newspapers in the city and would of course distribute them to the various vendors around the town. Having crossed over John's Bridge, which is still the same bridge that's there today, he began making his way up Lower John Street, that's up towards Langton's, kind of, if you know where we're talking about. At this point, he saw a Crossley tender lorry with Free State soldiers in the back coming down the street from the direction of the railway station. The lorry seemed to pick up speed suddenly as it swerved to avoid a horse and cart on the road. It then mounted the footpath. A group of teenagers jumped behind some scaffolding to avoid the Crossley tender. Some of the soldiers in the back of the lorry even jumped off the fast-moving vehicle. It came careering towards Griffin so quickly, and it all happened so fast, that he did not have a second to think or remove himself from its path. He was hit by the lorry just outside the post office and dragged some distance back towards the bridge before the lorry eventually came to a halt. The John Street sub post office was then located at number 82 John Street, which I believe is where Daly's D Front Room Bar is now located, kind of across the road from Biddy Early's pub, if any of you know it. So just to note, it's not McGrath's post office, which people would remember further up past Langton's, which was in place some later years. The Comfort family owned the post office at number 82 and another four buildings adjoining. The Comfort family helped lift Griffin inside, and PJ Comfort went and got a GP, Dr. John Mitchell, and also a priest, Father Mackey of St. John's, who performed the last rites. Three other priests also arrived to say prayers afterwards. However, Patrick Griffin, who was 47 years old, died a few minutes after the accident. One of his granddaughters told me a few years ago that his wife and some of his family managed to get down before he actually passed away to whisper a prayer in his ear. So it was all very, very sad and very, very tragic. So he left his wife, Joanna, and 12 children, all under the age of 23 years old. These included Bridget, Michael, Kathleen, Anthony, Andrew, Veronica, Teresa, John, Nora, Joanna, and Patrick Griffin Jr., who was just 5 years old when his dad died. There had actually been another baby, Patrick Griffin, but he died at 1 month old in 1908. So there are a lot of Patrick's descendants still around Kilkenny and beyond, and one of his grandchildren was good enough to allow me to have a copy of the photograph that's attached to this podcast. To me, the story always becomes more real to me anyway when I'm able to see what a person looked like, so the photo always humanizes it. Now, another man had better luck than Patrick that ill-fated morning. An employee of the Comforts named Johnson, who was employed at Comforts Bakery, was carrying a batch of bread to a van outside the door in John Street when events began unfolding. He was also hit and lifted onto the bonnet of the tender lorry. His injuries, though, thankfully, were not that serious. He was just carried down on the bonnet for a period. Controversially, the coroner decided against an inquest on the strength of representations made to him by the military. This appeared to most people to be an evasion of responsibility on the part of the Free State Army, and this event was even brought up in the Dáil in questions to the Minister of Defence, Richard Mulcahy. The driver later explained that the steering gear got out of action and the lorry sped off at a ferocious pace. I think kind of what he meant is it kind of went into neutral gear or out of gear and it just careered off on its own momentum. Again, we could also surmise that many of these Free State soldiers, including the driver, we don't know how much experience they would have had at driving these kind of vehicles. Many of them would have had very little experience at all, we can only guess. The lack of an inquest, though, was probably the army's way of saying that it was a tragic accident and there was no point dragging it on any further. This, of course, was of little consolation to Joanna and her 12 children. Patrick himself had been born on Patrick Street in 1875, so he didn't stray too far from home to raise his family. After the incident on John Street, his body was removed from Comfort's to the Central Hospital in Kilkenny, which is where the ESB offices, Macdonald Junction Shopping Centre, is today near Nolan Park. He was then waked at his residence in Patrick Street. The funeral mass and burial was held in St Patrick's Church nearby. Patrick Griffin, I suppose, was a victim of circumstance. It was a freak accident, but also, if the Civil War wasn't taking place, there would not have been a lorry full of soldiers making their way down John Street that morning. So his death would be classified as a civilian fatality of the Irish Civil War. Now, the youngest Kilkenny fatality of the entire revolutionary era in Kilkenny occurred on the 30th of September 1922. William Purcell, who was just 16 years old and from Kellymont, Paulstown, had enlisted in the Free State Army a few months earlier. He was accidentally shot in the stomach the previous day by one of his comrades in Templemore Barracks in County Tipperary. Friendly fire incidents, as we call them today, were very common during the Civil War in undertrained and young soldiers. Now, he lived for a number of hours after the shooting, but subsequently passed away as the bullets had severed a main artery. His mother, Annie Purcell, ran a public house and grocery in Paulstown. Only 4 years previously, in November 1918, she'd lost her husband, William Sr. He was just 37 years old when he died, having succumbed to the great flu epidemic of that year, leaving Annie to provide for their 7 children, the youngest being just 2 years old. The Free State Army reported his age as being 18 years old, with his age also recorded as that on his death certificate. The reasoning for this was most likely to avoid any adverse reaction that would accompany such a young death, but soldiers, not just in Ireland but in other armies, would often, if they looked old enough, would give a fake age just to enlist, and a blind eye was turned. Annie later received £65 in compensation from the government for the loss of her son. She had originally been offered just £40, as publicans were considered to be slightly better off than the average person. But this was increased to £65 after she appealed to W.T. Cosgrave, the local TD and chairman of the provisional government. But 2 years into the process, frustrated at the slow speed and bureaucratic nature of it, Annie wrote to the compensation board stating, quote, "Now I hope this will be the last letter that I will have to write. It's only God that knows what I have suffered for the last 2 years and 2 months for the loss of my poor boy. So I'll ask you, for God's sake, to settle it." End quote. She wasn't the first, and she wouldn't be the last, to lose patience with the bureaucratic process of the new Irish Free State to look for just a few pounds. Either way, it was not a large amount of money, even relative to the time, and would not go far in providing for a family of six. Now, on the 27th of November 1922, a number of Free State soldiers from Thomastown raided the Welsh farmstead in the townland of Bala near Hugginstown at 7:30 in the morning. Their information was obviously accurate, as a gunfight broke out when the Free State soldiers attempted to go up the stairs in the house. A bullet flew past the head of the Free State leader, James Ryan, when he tried to go up the stairs. The anti-treaty men escaped out the back, but a gun battle lasting nearly 3 hours took place as other anti-treaty men in the area arrived and were woken up from other houses and came to protect and to fight with their comrades. The Free State forces eventually withdrew, fearing the arrival of even more anti-treaty IRA enforcements. During the fighting, Edward Welch, a captain in the Free State Army and originally from the parish of Carrickshock, was shot and badly wounded, though he did survive. Daniel Callaner, an 18-year-old anti-treaty IRA man, was also badly wounded. He was a native of Jerpoint near Thomastown. Two wounded anti-treaty IRA men were also captured in follow-up searches. Robert Roach of Powerswood, Thomastown, suffered a shattered left arm, and a Keefe of Knockmylan suffered an arm wound as well during the fighting. They were all later imprisoned. In a similar story, on the 28th of November, just 2 days after that last event, a Free State Patrol near Inistigue was ambushed by anti-Treaty IRA, which resulted in a gun battle lasting over an hour. Although there were no reported casualties, an escaped prisoner from Dundalk jail, no less, Valentino Grady, was captured. So it just showed the connections between the anti-Treaty all over Ireland. They sent down Valentine down this neck of the woods, or he was on the run down here. Now, at the other end of the county, during the evening of Friday, the 1st of December 1922, so all this is happening in the same week, it was a very active week in Kilkenny that week, a party of anti-Treaty IRA entered the village of Johnstown in northwest Kilkenny. They ordered everyone off the streets and took cash from the post office. Word of the happenings in Johnstown was communicated to the Free State Forces based in Urlingford, which was less than 4 kilometres away. A patrol of Free State soldiers subsequently arrived on the outskirts of the village around midnight, at which point they were fired on. However, the anti-Treaty IRA quickly retired. The Free State soldiers cautiously made their way up through the streets in Johnstown village, which was deserted then by this time. At the upper end of the village, they saw 6 anti-Treaty IRA running across a field known as Morrissey's Field. The Free State soldiers ordered the men to halt. Shots were then fired by both sides. The Free State gave chase and fired at one of the men in the next field. Captain Patrick Cormack was struck while the rest of the anti-treaty party made their escape. Cormack had been shot in the leg and was bleeding profusely. A Free State soldier attempted to bandage the wound then, and then the local doctor, Matthew Mitchell, was called for and treated the injured man in a house nearby. Father Healy, the local curist, was also called. Cormack was then transferred by car with the intention of going to Urlingford Workhouse Hospital. However, he passed away in the early hours of the 2nd of December 1922 before he'd even arrived at the hospital. The bullets had severed the femoral artery in his right leg, which caused him to bleed out. He was very unlucky to be wounded in the first place, as owing to the darkness, the Free State soldiers were aiming at shadowy figures that they could scarcely discern, in their own words. Cormack was a native of that parish and from the townland of Grange Ferta, or just Ferta, or I've also seen it being written as just Grange, just a few hundred metres from where he was shot. He was just 24 years old and from a farming family of 10 children. He was captain of the Galmoy IRA, the F Company, during the War of Independence and was also a member of Johnstown Hurling Club. He was buried in the family plot in Fenner Graveyard. Now, the family were very well known and very well liked and respected in the area, especially as Patrick's grandfather had been a prominent locally in the Land League movement, which reached prominence, of course, a few decades previously. A few years earlier, Patrick's mother, Joanna, had stated on the census that her husband, who was also called Patrick, had left the family home when the kids were young and she was unaware if he was alive or when or if he would return home. Now, his mother Joanna was already dead at this stage. She actually died in 1914 of the flu, so both parents were gone. When Patrick's funeral took place in Johnstown in December 1922, the chief mourners were his grandmother, who was still alive, and also his brothers and sisters, of course. In addition, his former IRA company gave a big guard of honour, led by Lieutenants John Fitzpatrick of Galmoy and Thomas Feenan of Vaughan. It was considered one of the biggest funerals ever held in the area, as 200 carts, kind of horse and carts, took part in the funeral procession. Now, the family's name is sometimes recorded as MacCormack, and at the time of his death, Patrick Cormack's address was written as Steeple View in Johnstown. Now, just 2 weeks after the Johnstown incident, there was another tragic episode at the other end of the county. An attempt to assist the Free State Army had dire consequences for one individual. On the evening of Saturday the 16th of December 1922, two armed members of the anti-Treaty IRA, natives of Kilkenny City, raided the post offices in Fidown and nearby Piltown. Letters were opened with the intention of getting money, and letters were strewn all around the streets afterwards. People were also held up on the streets of Piltown. The men also stole a large amount of alcohol earlier the same day. Now, both men had previously been in the Free States Army, but then switched to the anti-treaty side. Now, on the day in question, it was not believed they were following any specific orders, but instead were acting on their own volition. As well as the post office raids, they also held up a lorry driven by Edward Mead of Fiddown, and people will know Mead's pub, the Tollbridge Tavern, that's still there today. Mead was on his way to a Christmas market with a consignment of turkeys he had reared. The IRA men took two of the largest turkeys before allowing the lorry to proceed. The men were probably a little bit worse for wear at this stage. Now then, another man kind of joined the party. He was Patrick Martin from Monkine, and he had been socialising in the local pub in Fiddown after a funeral. I began talking to the two men as he had recognised them, we believe, from the Free States Army. Martin himself had enlisted in the Free States Army in Carrick-on-Shore at one stage a few months previously, but had later deserted. When, however, one of the IRA men was asleep on the roadside, Martin took the opportunity to seize this man's revolver. In the meantime, a Lancia motor car containing a number of Free States soldiers from Clonmel was travelling towards Piltown, having received a message about the disturbances in the village. Now, tensions were already running high that week as the Free States Army had been left shell-shocked by the anti-treaty IRA after the latter had raided the barracks in nearby Carrick-on-Shore, and also, by the way, in Callan, Thomastown and Mullinavast during the week. As the Free States soldiers came near the village of Piltown, they saw Patrick Martin waving the revolver. Believing he was one of the reported IRA men, they opened fire on him with a machine gun, hitting Martin a number of times in the chest. It was only later the soldiers learnt their mistake. Martin had been waving the gun in an effort to attract their attention to bring in the two men who were probably asleep at this stage. A local priest, Father Phelan, gave Martin the last rites. However, he passed away before even reaching the hospital in Carrick. He left behind a wife and a young family. He had previously been wounded in action during the First World War as well. One of the other anti-treaty IRA men named Kelly was also badly wounded, having been struck a number of times by machine gun bullets. He was also given the last rites, although it's believed he survived. The other man, Michael Fitzpatrick, was arrested and imprisoned in Clonmel. It was, however, a very tragic turn of events for 28-year-old Monkine native Paddy Martin. Now, we don't know the exact story of what happened that day. He may have been socialising with the two men as they had a few free drinks to hand. Perhaps deciding the game was up with the arrival of the Free States soldiers, he was going to throw in his lot with the Free States soldier side and get the two men arrested. Maybe that was his plan all along. But in the Free State military report about the incident, they accused Martin of fraternising with the two looters during the day. But of course, this could also be the Free State Army's way of mitigating their responsibility for his death. We will never know, of course. Either way, Paddy Martin's ill-fated attempt to endeavour to do his civic duty, whether genuine or not, backfired badly. But opening machine gun fire on three men who hadn't fired at them was still a relatively harsh response by the Free State. But as I said, they were probably on tenterhooks. Though it does explain why the Free State authorities didn't hold an inquest into Martin's death either. Now, the Burke family of Urlingford had a bleak Christmas in 1922 as well, following the passing of their 19-year-old son, Edward. On Christmas Eve, Burke had been out with his friends in the village of Johnstown, just 4 kilometres down the road, and this is only a few weeks after the previous event in Johnstown. They were celebrating the festive season, as people would do, of course, on Christmas Eve, while his friends got into an altercation with the new civic guards in the area. Fighting broke out between the two groups, and the guards called the military garrison from Urlingford for a bit of support. The scuffle was still ongoing when the Free State soldiers arrived. Burke attempted to stop one of his friends from going onto the street to engage soldiers. Just then, a shot was fired by the military, which resulted in Burke being hit in the head. He was brought to Urlingford for medical help, but died there 3 hours later. Burke came from a family of 11. His body could not be released to his family until an inquest was heard, which could not take place until the evening of the 26th of December, Stephen's Day, due to the break of Christmas Day. We can only imagine what Christmas Day 1922 was like in that household. The inquest held in Urlingford found that Edward Burke died as a result of a gunshot wound which caused a laceration of the brain fired by some persons or persons unknown. The Free State Army in Kilkenny let it be known to GHQ in Dublin that they had no intention of punishing the soldier responsible. In a report dated 27th of December 1922, which has been released in the archives just in recent years, the following was stated, quote, Edward Burke shot during an attack on the civic guard. It is believed he was shot by a national that Free State soldier. It is not proposed to attempt his identification, end quote. So they weren't going to find out who did the shooting, which of course again was little consolation for the Burke family. Now, just to finish off maybe in a little more lighter note, and just to show the far-reaching effects of the Civil War in Kilkenny, the following story illustrates the quirks of history, maybe the sliding doors effect, so to speak. Iconic Kilkenny artist Tony O'Malley was a young boy of just 9 years old living in Callan when the Civil War broke out. O'Malley would later achieve international renown as an artist of note, but was nearly snuffed out before it even had begun. O'Malley had an accident on the big bridge in Callan town, which had been blown up by retreating anti-treaty IRA forces in July 1922, just in the first few weeks of the Civil War. The bridge had not been fixed by September as O'Malley and his classmates returned to school. Although there was makeshift planks put across the bridge to allow people to cross over. That's if they were brave enough to do so. O'Malley was told by his mother that under no circumstances was he to attempt to cross the big bridge on his way to school. Instead, he was to use the small footbridge crossing at the friary, which the friars had permitted the general public to use. Of course, like most young boys, O'Malley ignored his mother's advice. The thrill of walking across the planks with his schoolmates seemed more appealing than the friary bridge. In later life, Tony described the episode himself. Quote, myself and three or four others, nothing would do us but to go across the planks. But I slipped in the middle of the bloody planks, fell into the river and broke my arm. An old man on the bridge smoking a pipe came down in and rescued me. He took me up and pulled me out of the water and we all went to school together. This will tell you what terror of authority was at the time that they wouldn't miss school. I was drenched with my arm limp, probably broke, and I stood in the classroom above and it had to be explained to the Christian brother what had happened to me. I was taken up then to Dr. Phelan and he bandaged me up and sent me home. I had to go back by the Friary Bridge. Then there was great wailing from my mother about doing the wrong thing and going across on the plank, recriminations and character assaults. End quote. And of course, the Butler Gallery in Kilkenny houses the O'Malley collection, which you can visit for free. It comes highly recommended. It of course includes the collection of his wife, fellow artist Jane O'Malley too. Fate was certainly on his side back in 1922. What would the Butler collection in Butler Gallery, and indeed the art community generally, be like without the work of Tony O'Malley? It doesn't bear thinking about. And I hope these stories today have broadened your horizons on what represents the front line of war. Everyone deserves to be remembered. And I think that's where we leave it there today. Just to thank you all once again for listening. And don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the brilliant free resources. Until next time.